There's a deep reverence and respect for the elements of water, sky, and earth, sun and moon, that we'll find when we engage with cultures that have developed in the middle of the ocean, away from the speed of mainland societies. Island Wisdom, Lessons from Hawaiian Culture, our topic here today on An Organic Conversation, your show on everything that makes life worth living. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we are dedicating this show to my former co-host Sita Rani Palomar, who recently has moved to Hawaii to work with sustainability initiatives in the Pacific region. And Sita has a little farewell to our listeners that we wanted to read. Thank you to all the people who have tuned in over the years, who have let me be a storyteller, who have found health and happiness in the holistic bite. You have made these last 6 years enriching for me, and I will carry these memories forward as I support sustainability initiatives in the Pacific. I hope my work makes you proud, honors our shared values, and brings our community even closer together. Aloha and Godspeed, Sita Rani Palomar. Well, Sita, good luck in your new endeavors from all of us here at An Organic Conversation. And how fitting, Island Wisdom, Lessons from Hawaiian Culture, our topic in this hour with an amazing guest. All that is coming up. Stay tuned. And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. Island Wisdom is our topic in this hour, what we can learn from the culture, in this case, of Hawaii. The show is made possible through the fantastic support of our underwriters. Thank you to Bowman College, a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. Their professional training programs prepare individuals for successful careers as nutrition consultants and natural chefs. Are you interested in making healthy food your profession? More about their classes on holistic nutrition and culinary arts at bowmancollege.org. Also, thank you to Earls Organic Produce, a national distributor of organic fruits and vegetables. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. And also thank you to Fry Vineyards, America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry Vineyards, Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com. This is An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and our topic in this hour is Island Wisdom, Lessons from Hawaiian Culture. And with us now is Kevin Hoke, the CEO and president of the Hawaiian Outrigger Experience and Hawaiian Ocean Sports, who's joining us from Wailuku, Hawaii. Kevin, are you there?
Aloha,
good morning. Wonderful to have you on the line with us. You are operating an outrigger company on Maui, and I got to spend a week on Maui just a few weeks ago. And what really struck me was your incredibly deeply rooted reverence for Hawaiian culture. It was just such an unexpected trip where, you know, you would expect kind of a little bit more of a touristy experience, and you made it so real and spiritual. How were you taught? How did you grow up learning about the culture of Hawaii?
First of all, I appreciate the opportunity of being on your show. I appreciate you coming out on the canoe and experiencing the Hawaiian culture. So in reference to your first question, at an early age, I was blessed to have kupuna. Hawaiians say kupuna are our elders, our parents, our grandparents, our relatives, close friends. And if you break the word kupuna up into two words, the first two letters are ku. Ku is to stand. The last four letters, puna. Puna is the source. So I had to stand on the source of all these great people that helped shape my life, that helped influence my experiences. So I was blessed to have kupuna, elders in my life, parents, cousins, aunties, uncles, and close friends.
So kupuna, what really struck me during that trip was like the how you break down language into meaning, and kupuna is a perfect example. When did you really realize as a little boy, what was the moment when you got the wisdom, when you made the connection that this understanding and your culture actually mattered to you and was you?
Well, personally speaking, I think about 10 years ago, I really came to the realization and had an epiphany that, you know, I was raised a specific way. I was born and raised in Hawaii and had an opportunity to go to college in the mainland in California, and then I lived in Oregon. And it was only after those life experiences that I really began to miss my culture. So I moved back to Maui, and I began to reflect on my life experiences. My grandmother, Eleanor Hiram Hope, she had a tremendous influence on my upbringing in establishing cultural values. Yeah, so I had a chance to spend a lot of time growing up with great people that helped influence me. My grandmother was one of 12 kapu children in the history of Hawaii to learn all the ancient Hawaiian chants, hula, and traditions. So after birth, she was taken to the North Shore of Oahu for the next 13 years of her life. She was raised learning all the ancient Hawaiian chants, hula, and traditions. Yeah, so she was one of 12 by her own self-report, and being the last one to have to learn the ancient Hawaiian ways in becoming a master kumuhula. My grandmother was recognized by the state as being one of 5 master kumuhula. So it taught me a lot about a culture.
Do you have some examples? Like what happened 10 years ago? You left the island, actually. In what kind of mindset did you leave? Were you happy to be finally gone and have some experiences of the mainland? Or you spent, 10 years or 15 years in Oregon? What made you leave?
Yeah, after graduating high school in 1985, I went to college in California, and then I lived in Oregon for 15 years and worked with kids. And, I began to miss Hawaii and my Hawaiian culture. I mean, I was always connected, but I really missed that physical connectivity. And so I decided to move back to Hawaii about 10 years ago, and it was then that I realized that, you know, I had another purpose in this chapter in my life, and that purpose was to perpetuate the Hawaiian cultures through surfing and canoeing. And I started Aloha Surf School and Hawaiian Outrigger Experience with the purpose of perpetuating the Hawaiian culture through these activities. So I was blessed to be a part of that, and to also perpetuate the Hawaiian culture through the education and understanding of our Hawaiian history. Yeah?
And that's why we have you on the show. This is an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we are speaking with Kevin Hoke. We're right back after the break. Stay tuned. This is an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we are speaking with Kevin Hoke, the CEO and president of Hawaiian Outrigger Experience and Hawaiian Ocean Sports. The website is hawaiianoutriggerexperience.com or hawaiianoceansports.com on Maui. Coming back, what did you miss specifically, or realizing when you had returned? What was missing in your life? What have you learned in the last 10 years just for you to be on the mainland for that long, studying here and then working as a counselor in Oregon for 15 years and then returning? What did you experience? What did you miss that you realized afterwards, maybe even more than when you were living on the mainland?
Yeah, good question. I think a sense of pride and reflecting back on the Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian history and really researching the illegal overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy in 1893, really reflecting on our last reigning queen, Queen Liliuokalani, who she was imprisoned in her own palace by the United States and business people that were interested in taking control over Hawaii. So in 1893, there was the illegal overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy and illegal occupation of Hawaiian to this date. So that really motivated me personally to dive into my culture and to evaluate what happened and, most importantly, how I could help perpetuate the Kanaka Maoli, the Hawaiian culture, yeah?
So what are some of those cultural values? The tour I did with you in the Outrigger was a little over an hour, and it was already packed with navigational references and the sun and the moon. And when you talk about cultural values, what does it come down to for you? What does Hawaiian or island culture stand for? Being removed from the mainland, you know, growing up without that speed of consumption, perhaps a much closer relationship to the ocean, to water, to the sky, to the stars. Again, navigation was such a big topic when we went out, but what are some of the examples of cultural values that Hawaiian tradition stands on?
Yeah, well, Hawaiians were the pioneers in surfing, right? They introduced surfing to the world, and they were master navigators. Hawaiians have an expression that goes like this, he va'a he moku he moku he va'a, which translates to the canoe is our island or island is our canoe. Yeah? So the Hawaiians use this expression as a metaphor in life, that we are all in this canoe in life together. Yeah, and if you think about it, you're traveling from Tahiti to Hawaii and throughout the Polynesian Triangle. Keep in mind that way back when, there were no Coast Guard, no lifeguards and military to rescue you. So when you loaded your family up in that va'a, in that canoe, you were all in a canoe together, yeah? And everyone had, kuleana, had responsibility to paddle, to rig, to fish, to care for one another, because there was no plan B. Once you got on that canoe, you were all in that canoe in life together, yeah? Life or death were basically within your hands. So I appreciate that expression because we're all in this canoe in life together. And on the canoe, you learn some values and principles that permeate the Hawaiian culture, the first of which is Malama. Malama means to take care of, preserve, to serve with honor. So we always malama each other, take care of each other while we're in the canoe, while we're in life. We all have kuleana. We all have great responsibility to be good stewards of our land, to love one another, to steward our natural resources, to perpetuate the cultures and values. To always be pono, yeah? To always do what's right, what's morally right, to always have integrity, to live righteously. And I would say, lastly, value that I am most proud of is to always have aloha for each other, yeah? To always love one another, to care for one another. Most everyone knows aloha to mean hello, goodbye, I love you, but to Hawaiians, to Kanaka Maoli, aloha had a deeper meaning. And to truly understand that deeper meaning, you have to break the word aloha up into two words. The first three letters of aloha are alo, A-L-O. Alo literally in Hawaiian means face-to-face or in the presence of. And then the last two letters of aloha are ha. Ha is your breath of life. So anytime I greet friends, family, we always share our ha, our breath of life. We do that by putting our right hand on each other's shoulder, touching foreheads and noses, and inhaling together to share our breath of life with one another. Yeah.
That's so beautiful. That's Kevin Hoke, the CEO and president of Hawaiian Outrigger Experience and Hawaiian Ocean Sports. Again, HawaiianOutriggerExperience.com, HawaiianOceanSports.com, who's joining us today from Maui in this hour of an organic conversation, Island Wisdom, Lessons from Hawaiian Culture. I'm Helge Hellberg, and Kevin, we'll take a really quick break, and then we'll be back. I want to talk about the language. What really struck me, even in just that 1 hour with you in the Outrigger, you were able to show in a way the simplicity of how Hawaiian language is put together by symbols, by representations of exactly what you just said with aloha. It's a construct of two words or two meanings put together. And there were several others from Haleakala, the mountain there, to other references. Let's dive right back in there after the break. Again, this is an organic conversation. We're right back after the break. Stay tuned. And we're back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. Our topic in this hour is Island Wisdom, Lessons from Hawaiian Culture. We're speaking with Kevin Hoke, the CEO and president of Hawaiian Outrigger Experience and Hawaiian Ocean Sports, who I got to meet on Maui. That's the west side of Maui. Is that correct, Wailea?
It's actually the southwest side of Maui.
Okay, not fully incorrect, but southwest side of Maui, yeah, Wailea Beach. And before the break, Kevin, we talked about language, Hawaiian language, so beautiful because it's all spoken in pictures, basically. Do you have a few more examples, like you were just able to explain aloha as the, I'm sharing the breath of life with you?
Yeah. Well, more specifically, and focusing on, you know, Wailea Beach where we operate. The traditional name of Wailea Beach was known as Honua'ula. Honua is sacred red earth, Honua'ula. Honua means sacred, ula is red, sacred red earth. So in old Hawaii, they divided their land into mokua districts. Maui has 12 districts. The name of that district in Wailea is called Honua'ula, sacred red earth. And then as far as the two volcanoes that encompass Maui, we have Hale Aka La. Hale is house, La is sun, means house of the rising sun. The other volcano is Hale Mahina. Hale is house, Mahina is moon, house of the moon.
And all those landmarks, of course, again, served Hawaiians as they were navigating without any instruments, trips up to 2,500 miles to other islands, I learned from you, which is astonishing, really, when you consider 2,500 miles on the open ocean without any kind of sextant or other navigation, even a compass, right? They didn't use any of those tools.
Correct. Good point, Aga. So Hawaiians were and still are master navigators. Currently, there is a navigation canoe called the Hokulea. Hokulea was built by the Hawaiians in 1976, I believe. And the purpose was to sail to Tahiti using the ancient art of wayfinding or celestial navigation. As you mentioned earlier, Hawaiians didn't have any modern technology, no compass, GPS, maps, clocks, or sextants. So what they had to use is what's called wayfinding, or celestial navigation. The stars were our map in heaven, yeah? So they'd memorized 220 stars in traveling from Hawaii to Tahiti. Most importantly, they used the rising and setting points of the sun. We know that the sun always rises in the east and sets in the west. Hawaiians say there are 32 houses on the horizon in which the sun, moon, and stars end up into every day and every night. But the thing is, every day and night, that angle is different. Yeah. So think about it. You have to memorize 220 stars, which house they land into every day and night, 365 days out of the year. A very complex form of navigation. The Hawaiians also use the wind, yeah? The prevailing wind is east-northeast. They say you can blindfold a master navigator. I believe today there are five. They're called PO, P-W-O. And you can blindfold a master navigator, put him out on the canoe, and he'll tell you where north, south, east, and west is just by feeling the waves hit the canoe and the wind against his body. They also use birds, two types of birds. The no'eo goes out at sunrise, leaves the island, goes out 40 miles, feeds, returns back to the land at sunset. The manu'oku leaves the island in the morning at sunrise, goes out 120 miles, feeds, returns back to the land at sunset. So the Hawaiians were smart. They just looked for these birds in the evening, followed them in the direction that they're going, knowing that depending on which bird they saw, they were 0 to 120 miles away from an island. Just follow the birds at sunset. They'll take you right back to the island. Yeah. The last thing they look for is over all these islands are these cotton ball-looking clouds. They only form over islands because of the curvature of the earth. You may not always see the island from a great distance, but you can almost always see the clouds. So you look for those cotton ball-looking clouds. So currently, Hokulea, about a year ago, launched this voyage from the Big Island to Tahiti, Tahiti to New Zealand, New Zealand to Australia, Australia to Africa, Africa to Brazil, Brazil to the Virgin Islands to Cuba, Cuba to Florida, and just last week, Hokulea landed in New York. So within the last year, Hokulea has traveled 23,000 miles. Over the next 2.5 to 3 years, Hokulea is going to travel to 20 different countries to preach this message of Malama Honua, which means to take care of this earth.
So that integration of using all these existing truths, right? The birds and the clouds, like that embedded nature within the culture and within really survival. It was not just something to be honored for its beauty, but for sheer survival and navigation and exploration. How do you, when you come in touch with tourists who spend, you know, an hour or 2 hours with you, how are you able to communicate those values to people who visit Wailea Beach or who come to your business and want to have an outrigger experience?
We always have a positive experience with people that come on the canoe because, you know, I think the canoe and surfing, they reinforce some universal principles of connectivity and a relationship, yeah? And surfing and canoeing encompass and reinforce these principles. For one thing, the same percentage of salt exists in the ocean as in the human body, yeah? Maybe that's why we have this desire to go to the ocean, mm-hmm. yeah? And if you look at it, the ocean and canoes all connect us geographically, yeah? No matter the distance, the ocean always connects us. We can always travel by canoe. And you know, while we're in the canoe, we're all one ohana, one family, yeah? Each person is responsible for the other, yeah? Remember, there are no Coast Guard, lifeguards, or military, you know? All you have are yourselves that help keep you safe.
So you personally doing tours with people literally every day of the week and knowing there was this overthrow of the American government at the turn of the century, 1800, 1900, and knowing that some of these beaches were only reserved for kings and are now open for, you know, hotels. And how do you stay motivated? How do you not get bitter? What's your secret?
Good question, Margaret. You know, we'll have to look at our last reigning queen, Queen Liliuokalani. Yeah? She was imprisoned in her own palace in 1893. And if you could just think about that for a moment. She was imprisoned in her own palace, and she dictated to her people, yeah, to get rid of the opala, the rubbish out of your heart, and to demonstrate to the world your aloha, even to have aloha for people that were keeping her captive, yeah. So that in itself is motivation to me that, you know, my last reigning queen had aloha for people that did her wrong. And I have a kuleana, great responsibility to the world to share that aloha. So that's a prime motivating factor for myself to follow what my last reigning queen instructed, to love one another.
And how do you remind yourself going to work every day too? Or is that at this point, 10 years after returning from the mainland, is that in every gene of your body? Or do you have a practice to, or is that the moment you walk onto the beach and blow that muscle, blow the conch shell? What's your practice to stay in that aloha spirit?
Yeah, my personal practice is always to wake in the morning and always mahalo akua, to always give thanks and praise to God for allowing me to be in Hawaii and to be in this special place, and to always acknowledge Him and to know that, you know, I have an impact on other people and to demonstrate to the world aloha, love.
And you certainly do. That's Kevin Hoke, the CEO and president of Hawaiian Outrigger Experience and Hawaiian Ocean Sports on Maui, on the southwest shore in Wailea Beach. Let's talk about that. We're almost out of time, but I do want to get into the reaction you create from guests. Yes, you get to do this. And I believe it is really well received. At least our Outrigger tour was amazing and people were very much touched. We paddled out. We saw a bunch of honus, of turtles. What are the reactions you get from guests? It inspired me to invite you to be part of the show, which I would think doesn't happen every week. But how do you feel people who are on vacation, how are they open to consider these deeply spiritual and important reminders to live consciously?
Good question. like I said, the results are always positive, and I think people have a positive experience because, one, they're getting into a canoe, and they're learning about the history of Hawaii. They get to physically paddle a canoe, the same type of canoe that the Hawaiians use in paddling throughout the Polynesian Triangle. You know, they're working together. They're practicing principles of lotahi, or unity, you know. We get to see honu, turtles. During whale season, we get to see the humpback whales, or pohola. We just get to be a part of nature. And there's something about being in the ocean that's liberating. And just working together and paddling a canoe is something of beauty. And each one of us is reliant on the other to make sure that the canoe pulls forward. We're all in unison. I teach traditional Hawaiian chants, yeah, that allow us to work together, to bond together, to connect with each other, all in the same canoe. I think all those factors, and just being out on the ocean, seeing how beautiful Maui is, seeing all the islands surrounding Maui, Lanai, Ho'olawe, Molokini. You have Haleakala, House of the Rising Sun, 10,023 feet as your background. Just the overall beauty of Maui in general. All create this positive experience.
What do you think people take home as what's the most important message? This is kind of your chance to speak to our entire audience, which is listening in from 135 countries, to an organic conversation. If you had to distill it, I know family comes up a lot, or it seems like the Hawaiian culture is almost entirely based on family. That's where it starts. A reverence for the elders, for traditions, for cultures, and then being in service of. But I want to ask you, if you had one distilled message for the world or your guests to convey, what would be the most important one?
Again, I have to go back to aloha, because it encompasses so many things: love, affection, compassion, mercy, sympathy, kindness, and showing kindness, sharing your breath of life with one another upon every interaction. So I would say always aloha.
And then we did learn this amazing little chant on the boat. Would you be able to do that for our audience?
Sure.
Thank you.
So it's traditional that any time you enter the mountain or the ocean, you offer up an oli chant. It's asking permission for us to enter the water, yeah? And it's called Eho Mai. It's also asking for protection and asking that all the people of the ocean, yeah? Because 75% of the world is filled with water. Hawaiians say Ikamuana, all the people of the ocean. We're asking them to share their hidden knowledge with us. So, yeah, this is called Eho Mai, and it goes like this. Eho Mai, kaike mai luna mai ye. Una mea huna no ea una bele. Eho Mai, Eho Mai, Eho Mai ye. Mahalo. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. And what a beautiful sentiment, actually, to ask for permission. And when you say the waters, of course, water stands for emotions. And we so often don't ask for permissions to be part of an emotional journey. If we are allowed to enter and to bring forth kindness and service. So lots of metaphors, lots of literal wisdom.
but also lots of metaphors for life itself. And I really think that is what island states who are not have developed over, with the speed of mainland cultures and societies, that deeply rooted connection to nature and reverence to something bigger than us, sky and ocean, is really what makes Hawaiian culture in this case so special. Wonderful to have you on the show. And I do want to share the breath of life with you one more time. Aloha. Are you going back to the beach right now?
Yep.
Another day in Maui. Is there an Hawaiian goodbye that you can offer?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So in Hawaii, we never say goodbye. We always end by saying, ahui ho. Ahui ho means until we meet again, never goodbye. So ahui ho, and I look forward to the next time we can see each other. I'd love to take you out surfing with Aloha Surf School and out on the canoe with Hawaiian Outrigger Experience.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Kevin. Pleasure to have you on the show today.
Mahalo.
Thanks for all your work. Mahalo. See you soon. Bye-bye. And that's Kevin Hoke, who joined us today from Maui, from the southwest beach of Wailea. Kevin Hoke is the CEO and president of Hawaiian Outrigger Experience and Hawaiian Ocean Sports. That's HawaiianOutriggerExperience.com, HawaiianOceanSports.com, and also the owner of Beach Club Maui. Born in 1966, he's really a representative of Hawaiian culture, having lived several years, almost two decades, on the mainland and then returned to Maui to start his business there, but really just using that as the foundation to being an exemplary representative of Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian wisdom. Kevin Hoke, again, look him up. If you go to Maui, it's worth the experience, absolutely. And that's our show today on Island Wisdom, Lessons from Hawaiian Culture. This is An Organic Conversation. I am Helge Hellberg, and we'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. And we're back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. And our topic in this hour was Island Wisdom, Lessons from Hawaiian Culture. Switching gears now, here's the update from the world of healthy organic fruits and vegetables. Here is what's in season. And it's the voice of the San Francisco produce market, Mr. Organic, on the line.
Hello, Helga.
Hey, Earl. Thanks for making time. And we talked about stone fruit last week, and you were saying that every day now, June, berry-focused and still like local domestic, really local, was still waiting to come in. It's now coming in on a daily basis. What's the newest item this week?
I reported on a grower down in the Santa Barbara area. Elwood Farm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, his name was Jack.
And oh, yeah, you visited that farm in March. We had you on the show, and you were just down there.
Yeah, I think at that point, he had a production of a snap peas coming in, and so we revisited Jack, and at that time, he was telling me what his plans were, and he's followed through on those plans, and he's put in it's about 5 or 6 acres of heirloom tomatoes.
Hmm.
And for him, this is very exciting. He's never grown that much acreage, even though it doesn't sound like very many. And he's never grown the different varieties that he's doing. A lot of this was us supporting him, telling him, you know, we definitely have an outlet for this, and he also likes to grow it, and also where he is, it's a good area to produce. There's a history there of producing tomatoes.
Well, and tomatoes are really prolific, right? So even on a relatively small acreage, that's actually not that small, but that's a lot of tomatoes.
It absolutely is. And depending upon the weather, the production can really get crazy. You know, they can swing hard either way,
yeah.
Meaning they can be a huge production or you can have a lower production. So you really have to be ready. You know, there's some interesting things about what Jack did this year. He has property that does have hillsides, and he was what he wanted to do was to, on one of his frost-free hillsides, he wanted to get an early crop in, and that, you know, getting inside the mind of a grower is, you know, what is the strategy that he's putting forth in how he's managing his land. And when he can get an extra crop in, whether it's the beginning of the year or at the end of the year, that can make a difference between whether, you know, he reaps a financial benefit or not. I mean, in other words,
yeah, it makes or really breaks the farm. That's right. Yeah.
So this year he did not go in that early because there was a lot of forecasting back in January and February about an El Nino, and he wasn't sure quite how that was going to play out. In retrospect, he could have gone in and planted there and gotten an early crop. So now that he knows that, you know, he's going to be looking very closely at almanacs and talking to other growers and getting forecasts is what it looks like next year. If he can get that early planting in, he will, in fact, have heirlooms, local heirlooms, if you will, by the end of May, which would be, you know, fantastic.
Well, it's an interesting story because people, you know, when we look at produce in the retail aisle, we often don't recognize the entire story and the risks and the considerations that went into producing that crop. So for a smaller beginning farmer like Jack, you know, having one crop more, making or breaking the farm, if you do that 3-4 years in a row, that can create either, you know, some kind of stability or real hardship if you didn't hit it right. And it's interesting that story is never told, right? You just see produce. Yeah. We're used to it. We don't even really pay attention to the farm name often, depending on your grocery stores. There are some now through your education that really emphasize the farm again and the farmer and make it a story, really tell the story of the land and the history and the farmer's family. And when we do that, wow, it's a daily risk-taking. It's basically really just farming is risk mitigation, right? They constantly deal with weather, seasons, pest pressures. It's all organic. So, you know, trying to manage what is almost unmanageable and trying to predict what is certainly unpredictable seems like it's such a bargain when we then get an amazing piece of produce for, you know, a couple bucks.
Oh, you know, I absolutely agree with you. That is precisely it. You know, the growers, what many of them are looking to achieve is growing on the shoulders of the season, which means either early in the season or late in the season, because that is when they have best opportunity to get top dollar, because there's less production, because they're the ones that you know, made the risk and it came in for them, and so they can get the top dollar. On both ends, or if there's a failure, then you're rolling the dice on that too. You know, maybe a frost came, you know, 2 weeks after you put the transplants in, or maybe the, you know, heavy rains came 2 weeks in a row, and those, you know, so by following, you know, the histories of that geographical place, talking to you know, looking at forecasts and talking and just knowing your land, that's why these last couple of years, 5 years, 10 years, have been so difficult, because it is outside of forecasting.
Yeah.
And to think that you can have 5 years running of still no rain, and people putting in the bet, putting in the risk, this year we're going to get it. So it's a great story. It affects us in ways we have no idea, and these small farmers are really the backbone of the organic and his, of course, historically, of the agricultural trade itself.
Well, important to remember, really great reminder, thank you, for all of us as consumers, that if we support organic and small farms, the the risk and hardship those people take on to bring us our food that we then get to enjoy. It's an honor to support that. And, you know, I'm not saying price doesn't matter, but wow, the quality that is being produced out of that risk, and we get to honor that. It's just important to hold that and really respect that.
Yes. Yeah, right. Couldn't say it better. No, I'm not trying to give the impression that all organic farms are small.
No.
And they're all family farms.
Sure.
Not at all. You know, we couldn't fill the need and the demand that's there. But there are, you know, I've made such great relationships with so many small growers that they're out there and they're all over the country in all these great geographical pockets. You have family farms living on the farm and having this great adventure, and we get the benefit from it.
Yeah, and we need them all, but it's just important to know your farmer, know where your food comes from, really, to a certain story level. And then you're a part of the production. You're co-creating, right? They need us as consumers, and they need us to know their story, just as we need to know the story. It's just a really good cycle.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, keep on creating that dialogue with your produce department.
Yes.
Keep asking those questions.
And go to Earl's website. That's earlsorganic.com. All those farmer stories and, of course, the produce items of the week, of what's rolling in and what's the best and how to pick it and choose it on earlsorganic.com. And that is Earl Herrick, the founder of Earl's Organic. Thanks so much for making time, Earl. We'll have you back next week.
Great talking to you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Later.
Bye. And that was today's edition of An Organic Conversation. The hope of young farmers and the reverence of island states, island wisdom, lessons from Hawaiian culture, our topic in this hour. And yes, how beautiful the idea of giving blessings and returning to a much deeper reverence for nature, doing good in the world, being of service, kindness, and asking for permission if we are allowed to enter or if we're allowed to do certain things in this world with other people on this planet. Just a deep form of respect. Mahalo again to Kevin, our guest today, and mahalo to Earl Herrick for what's in season and all the work that all these great people are doing every day. And mahalo to you, our listeners. This is An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we'll be back with another episode next week. See you then. Bye-bye. And that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thanks for listening. A big thank you to our associate producer, Kristen Ponger. An Organic Conversation is made possible through listeners like you and the fantastic support of our underwriters. Earl's Organic Produce, a national distributor providing certified organic fruits and vegetables for your store, home, or business. Are you a chef, have a catering business, or planning a party, or simply just love organic produce? Anyone can buy directly from Earl's Organic at wholesale prices. The website is earlsorganic.com. And also Fry Vineyards, America's first certified organic winery, producing organic and certified biodynamic wine without synthetic sulfites or other preservatives. Family owned and operated since 1980. Fry Vineyards, Mendocino County award-winning wines. For more information, frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com. Thank you as well to Bowman College, focused on holistic nutrition and culinary arts for over 20 years. Bowman College offers professional training programs that prepare individuals for careers as nutrition consultants and natural chefs. Their website is bowmancollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N college.org. If you missed parts of this show or for any other episode, go to anorganicconversation.com or subscribe to our show on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play so you'll never miss an episode. And for more information, health tips, recipes, and your daily dose of inspiration, find us on Facebook and Instagram. at An Organic Conversation, and our Twitter handle is Talk Organic. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we'll be back with another great episode right here. Same place, same time next week. See you then.